Go over a couple of things. I remembered like the most obscure memory. I hadn't thought about this in years, but it popped into my head, Ghostbuster style,
Yeah.
fairly recently. I want to know if you can re if you remember it. So I'll see how
Yep.
it goes there.
Sounds good.
Canterville Ghost discussion, I'm sure.
As per.
As well. Okay, it's episode 79, and I've got Richard Ellis back. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how you going, Maddie?
I'm all right. I'm all right. It's a lot
Yeah.
happening.
Ah, so exciting to be
We suffered a loss of our AFL team losing today, and a heartbreaking loss to be out of the finals. We won't dwell on that. Let's move straight past it very quickly. We've already
I think
commiserated off
could I just
air.
say that I'm very appreciative for the fact that my wife was actually at work during the game,
Oh,
which
good.
means I had to compose myself in order to feed and bathe and bed my children. So I think without that, I'd be a complete and utterly blubbering mess at the moment. So everything worked out for the best. I'm kind of had to pull my socks up and get back on with life, and that's where we're at.
I had to, it's my wife's birthday tomorrow, and she started festivities already with some afternoon cosmopolitans to drink. And then we were singing some karaoke earlier with both our children remonstrating that we're being too loud, especially with Justine's version of Hole's Violet. And that was good for
Oh my
everyone.
Lord.
Yeah.
Did you have a breakout number there?
She just kept saying, do this one. Putting songs on for me to sing that were horrible to sing. She put on We Didn't Start the Fire, which
Oh,
just
that's
not great.
oh.
And she also made the error, which many, many people have made at karaoke, which was she said, oh, I've got a duet we can do, and put on Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Elton John and Kiki D. Now, everyone loves that song, apparently, but it is the most boring, like, tuneless. I guess it's like the whitest song that's ever been.
I'm sorry.
So, moving very quickly past that, I wanted to start by asking you if you recall a memory. This popped into my head out of nowhere the other day. And I wonder if you remember the time at school when did both of us compared like a talent night? All kinds of performers, musicians, dancers. And I believe you and I compared. Do you remember this?
Are you sure it was me?
No, I'm not sure it was you that compared, if I'm honest, but I know this for a fact. We had this hilarious thing planned where the first time or the second time I came on stage to introduce an act, you were going to heckle me? Now, do you
Yeah.
remember this?
Yeah, I remember this, but I don't think I was, I think I'm my recollection was, and I could be very wrong here as well, is that it was you and possibly Lauren Willis
That sounds about right.
were comparing, and then, but we were kind of collectively writing it for some reason. We thought it was on par with the Academy Awards, requiring lots of input from around the place.
And we thought we
And
could do
so,
some bits and skits here and there.
yes, yeah, that was kind of the impression that, yeah.
But I don't know if you know the full story, because this is it turned out to be like one of my worst evenings ever on stage. And the reason was that we thought it'd be funny for you to heckle me. And then I don't know. I don't think we had anything scripted, which is a bad idea. When then I was going to rip into you and make everyone uncomfortable. How hilarious is that? But what actually happened was the performer who was about to come on, and we knew her, and she was a dancer, and she was going to do like a solo ballet thing. I told her before, I was like, before I introduce you, Ellis and I are going to do this hilarious thing, and blah, blah, blah. And I told her, and she said, please don't do that. It's like, no, it'll be really funny. She's like, no, I want to just do my dance and get off. And she was like, really freaking out. So I was like, okay, but I didn't tell you. There was no time to get the message to you. So what happened was you started heckling me, And I tried to ignore it, but because I didn't, I have no idea what it's like to be on stage. Everyone in the audience became horribly uncomfortable. And then I just fell apart. Like I couldn't get the words out for the rest of the night. Cause anytime I came on stage, everyone was like, is that guy going to heckle him again? And it just was a disaster. I remember just, oh God. And then by the end, I couldn't even say like, thank you to everyone. And saying the wrong words, it was just horrible. And all I can remember is, why did we think that was a good idea to begin with?
I think it's a fantastic idea. I still stand by it. Yeah, I think that, you know,
with no rehearsal, yeah, no rehearsal or expertise, but
oh, absolutely. But I think that, you know, we've had our invisible theater moments. That's yes, definitely up there. I think that, you know, it's we just needed a little bit more. I think we just need a little bit more structure in our
yes, yeah, definitely
ridiculousness. Like, you know, we needed that. We needed that fifth wall.
I just love. I love that. Look, looking back, that I know it'd be funny. Everyone will get uncomfortable, and then I was like, I didn't realize that by not doing the bit, then I would be horribly uncomfortable. And then anytime I came on the stage, everyone was immediately like, "Oh no, this guy's dying." And then I was like, I wanted to say, "I'm not. No, no, you don't. No, you don't understand, guys." It's a complete backfire.
There's so many moments when you look back at that age and just go, what was I thinking? Like, seriously, like, what on earth was going through my head at that time to think that this was in any way, shape, or form a good idea? But I think that that's what you got to do. You know, yeah, you got to go through and have those wonderful, wonderful failures in order to move on. But, yeah, I'm really racking my brain and I'm having a lot of trouble even because I know that we had the Night of the Freaks lined up. Oh, and I remember yes, that was pulled last minute.
Yeah, so that was horrible,
always,
wasn't it?
That was a disappointment.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was always going to be.
That was one of the best like promoted. I love the promotion of that where we photocopied our faces and horribly
fantastic
weird pictures and then made up programs and they're like, no, that's not happening.
Well, I think that I think that once again, it was one of those things which where it was a slight, we almost didn't go far enough. I think that if we'd actually turned it into a proper sideshow, freak show style, almost an installation piece, that would have made it a much more interesting piece of theatre rather than everyone standing up on stage. I think that that would have been like a, that would have made it, I think, acceptable or almost kind of like a sideshow alley type thing. We could have gotten away with it. But by trying to present it on stage in a formal, boring ass kind of way, I think we kind of failed a bit on our asses. So, yeah.
But they didn't let us do it.
Oh, they didn't let us do it. Yeah. That's what I mean. Like, you know, I think it would have been better if we just did it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's weird to be shit canned in something that no one's actually paying for or.
Yeah, or really had any interest in. Like, it's basically going to be friends and family if that. Like, you know, it wasn't as if it would be.
Cancelled due to lack of interest. Yeah, I mean, that's how you establish a cult, isn't it? That's how a cult following of your show, no one's there. Oh, yeah. That's great. I told our good friend, Mr. Wiggo, that you were going to be here tonight. And he's got a couple of questions as well, just to race through. He said, how close did you get to a breakdown when you worked for Flight Center?
Oh, very close. I don't know. I was going through a very dark period in my life at that time. And I think that, the working in sales kind of exacerbated everything.
Mm.
And I don't know whether this is where Mr. Wiggins is going with this question or whether it was prompted by something else entirely.
Right. Yeah.
Like just through my general odd behavior and state of being, but it wasn't a good place. I think that when I was working as a chef, I was an alcoholic, but I was a happy alcoholic.
Yeah,
I think that working for Flight Center, I was miserable and drinking far too much, and everything kind of went a bit very pear-shaped there. So I don't know. I think I probably went over the edge a couple of times.
Right.
And kind of brought myself back. And I think that's where it kind of came down to get stuck into doing something different and
so what did getting that,
out of it.
What did that look like for you, if you don't mind me asking? Of like you said, going over the edge a couple of times.
I think that I was like to the point of drinking myself for days on end.
Right.
And basically not leaving the house and going to very just dark places within yourself. Like just that complete and utter feelings of worthlessness and not wanting to communicate with anyone else in the world. It wasn't pleasant. No. I never got any job satisfaction from it. I think that was a thing.
Yeah.
And like, you know, but that was only, I think that was only part of the problem. Like, you know, obviously the problem, you can't blame the job itself, but it was kind of, that definitely fed into everything else that was going on. So it was, yeah, it was, as I say, I just really, the concept of sales for me is a very weird way of judging yourself and success. And right. That was something that I never really came to grips with. And I think that I over intellectualized it. Like I overthought it and kind of started to, I was so adamant that I wasn't going to believe the hype that I kind of tried to double bluff myself into it, which sent me on a bit of a spiral. So yeah, it was a very, it was odd. It was an odd job and it was an odd time. It's very cultish as well. I think that's a thing as well, is that the people that you're with are absolutely fantastic, but they believe the hype.
Right.
And I couldn't get into it. And so I felt as if I was almost betraying them by not believing it. And so, yeah, it's a weird little company, that one. And right. Very glad to be out of that world, obviously, with the current state of the world.
Exactly right.
Yes. I've got nothing but absolute respect for everyone I worked with. Like, you know, they were I've made lifelong friends and would never ever, you know, I think they were all pretty well aware of where I stood. And so hopefully this is I don't think anyone will be shocked to hear me saying this, but yeah, it was definitely it's a very different state of affairs. And so right. trying to come to grips with that was pretty tough at points.
It's hard. I mean, it's hard and it's, I mean, I don't, how old were you around that time?
Well, I'd just come back from overseas. So the big thing was that I wanted to get out of hospitality. I was looking for a 9-to-5 because I didn't want to be basically, and I always said, I didn't want to be 50 years old and hunched over a grill.
Yeah.
You know, scraping it down at 1 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, that's not a way to live a life and have a family and all that kind of thing. Like, you know, so that was pretty much, it was my segue into the, a 9-to-5 world was what I kind of thought. And I thought, oh yeah, you know, I'll get into this and then either go down that corporate path or something along those lines. But yeah, it just really wasn't for me. And I needed something a different, mindset, a different goal to work towards rather than that money thing. I think that was the big thing that it really taught me, was that I'd kind of flirted with the idea of going into TV and advertising and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But that really wasn't going to hit it for me. And that was a conversation I had with Tony because I got together with Tony and then I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is making me miserable. She was like, you need to stop doing this. This is making you miserable.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And so it was either, I said, look, I want to go into teaching, but we're probably, you know, we're never going to be rich as a result of it, but at least I might be somewhat happy. And, or we can, you know, I can look into going into something more corporate, like, you know, going to marketing or advertising or something like that. And she was like, no, just do what you want to do. Don't do something for the sake of the money. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah. So it's very, she's a smart lady.
Yeah. She has her moments. Absolutely.
So when it comes to like your career shift, one thing I've noticed with you in the last, you know, 10 years or however long that career shift has been, maybe it hasn't been 10 years, has it?
Has it been? It's coming up to, I've been teaching for 7, but obviously I went to uni for the 4 years before that. So, yeah.
Yeah. So what I've noted in you especially is you are very driven. So you have a lot on your plate and you have for, you know, since you've had a family and moved about a fair bit, but you are very driven to do your best as a teacher, an educator, You do your master's at the moment as well?
Yeah, I think that I think a lot of that came from those feelings that I had when I was working for Flight Centre. I think it comes out of that feeling of you've wasted your life.
Yeah.
Because for, and we've kind of touched on this in the past, during that kind of period in my 20s, I really did nothing and had an absolute ball doing it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and that was awesome. But then you kind of reach that moment. For me, it was late 20s and coming back and, you know, kind of, I kind of had that as my life plan, I suppose, to a certain degree,
yeah.
Was that, you know, I'm going to, where I kind of stuffed up, I suppose, was I probably should never, and I'll always say this, I should never have gone straight to uni from school. Like, I was nowhere near ready for going to uni out of school.
Yeah.
And so that was a huge monumental waste of time and money.
But yeah, it's hard. It's very hard to, like, I tell students this as well. They always, of course you would, but they look at me like with unbelieving, not disbelief. But when I say, look, there's no reason that you have to go to uni straight from school. Everyone wants you to do that, and especially your parents, because that is the less stress option for them. You know, your parents a lot of times just will be like, oh, you know, like you go to school, go to uni, get a job, done. You know, that will make them stress the least in their minds. But you don't realize that, oh, you know, like I went, so many people went to uni and did degrees that they never used just because they thought they should. And then again, they probably had a great time. I know a lot of people who had a great time at uni and then never used their degrees ever.
Yeah, but I think that the difference was is that they probably got their degrees. I'd never even did that.
Right.
So I never completed uni the first time around and then kind of pissed it all up against the wall for many years.
Did you carry that with you? Did you carry that? Did you feel any like sense of shame about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know, I completely attribute it to Catholic guilt. And so it's kind
of, I've been talking a lot about Catholic guilt lately. Yeah, go on.
Kind of ironically, it's kind of perverted itself into this Protestant work ethic that I've kind of got going, where I'm sitting there going, oh, you know, I've got to work hard to prove to God or whatever this, you know, omnipotent power is, which is just me, like, you know,
yes,
that, oh, I can do this, I'm better than I thought I was going to be, because, you know, and I've always been incredibly unambitious.
Right.
So all the way through, and I think that's something that I regret. I always attributed ambition with arrogance, and I think that's a completely wrong way of thinking about things. I think you can be incredibly ambitious and not arrogant, but I wasn't. I was probably the opposite. I was completely arrogant and not ambitious.
Yeah, but that's part of, I know exactly what you mean. Like a kind of like sneering look at ambitious people, though. Like it's very easy to do, a cynical like view of ambition. I'm pretty sure, you know, I had the same at that age, which is like, oh, like ambitious people are lame.
Yeah, like, but it wasn't.
Why would you want to be ambitious? Better just, you know, I don't know. I have a similar.
Yeah, but it was always, but it was almost that sitting there looking at ambitious people and go, oh, look at you. You're so full of yourself. You know what you want to do and you're going to work hard to get it. Ooh.
I know. I was very familiar.
It's just. Yeah. And for me, it was only kind of at that point that I'm kind of like, you know what? I'm sick of being, I think realizing that cynicism can only go so far.
Yes.
And I took a lot of pride in being a cynic and a lot of pride in being sarcastic and a lot of pride in being a smart ass for a long time. And it's only when I think that you start to realize, well, when I started to realize that it's not necessarily the healthiest mindset that, I could start to think about things differently. And, you know, I've still got a lot of growth and a lot of things to work on. But as I say, it's kind of nice to be ambitious and want to do my best for a change and putting my best work into things, like, you know, and being able to see what you can accomplish when you're actually trying at something, as opposed to saying, oh, I could have done that if I tried. But, you know, I just really like that. I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head. I think might have even been towards the end of year 12 or something like that, just saying that I was one of the most apathetic individuals
we
that you've ever met.
We had quite a lot of apathy going on in our friendship group, it has to be said.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But we were like literally, and I think this is what, and I think that I look back on, I think that's what has helped drive me now, motivates me now,
yeah.
is imagine what we could have achieved with just a little bit of, a little bit of motivation and a little bit of ambition, and a little bit of that kind of, an understanding that all we had to do was put in
do stuff,
a slight modicum of effort.
Just to do, actually do it. Like that's the great myth, isn't it? It's just, we could have just.
You got to start it. That's it.
That's right. It's so easy. It was so easy just to be like, nah, just nah. I mean, we could do that, but do we want to? Like, oh, I don't know. I see students do that too. And they're like, oh, I don't know. Like, oh, then I have to. Oh, it comes with its own set of problems. Like, yep, doing stuff.
I think it's me being a bit old man, like, you know, looking back and seeing things the way that they are now and going, oh, but if only I had this, but it's bullshit. Like, you know, there's no way that, like, but I just think of, like, you know, we were always into doing the short films and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I just think that then a lot of our restraint around that was, you know, I sat there and edited our year 12 video with two video recorders and printouts of paper recording the, transitions and intermission and stuff like that. Like, you know, that was a lot of effort getting that done.
Yeah.
But, you know, to say that that was the reason that you couldn't make a movie or do something is absolute bullshit. We could have sat there and done it.
Yeah.
It was just about because other people were doing it and other people did do it, but we just went,
I think I don't know, like, does the cynicism cover just the fear of being shit at something? You know, like just
absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, we don't want to do it. Oh, it's gonna be lame. But you're just like, what if we spend all our time doing something?
Isn't
it? Yeah. We spend all our time doing something. Even the stuff we made, like even in regards to other podcasts we've made, there's always been like I hope no one actually sees this or hears this. And I don't know why when you think of it. Like what is wrong with the you know, people looking at it and saying that's shit. Like you want to make anything, right? You want to make anything, that's going to happen.
Yeah, well, that's exactly. But I think, there's something. I think it's a bit of a George Costanza, I can't have success type thing. As soon as something successful happens to me, then something bad is going to happen. It's like that karma, that balance in the universe. That's my kind of take on most things. So I'm perpetually petrified of having too much success. And even at the moment, I'm living in an existential fear that, you know, I've bought a house and have a family and things aren't going too badly at the moment, that something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, the shoe's going to fall. Yeah, right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any second. So and it sounds ridiculous, but that's a constant lingering fear in the back of my mind. Yeah. And I think that that's something which, and as I say, I don't think that comes from, stems from Catholic guilt more than anything
else. Yeah. Do you deserve to be successful?
I don't deserve. That's exactly right. I don't deserve any success. I'm a sinner. Sinners don't deserve any of this type of thing.
You are a sinner. That's very true. Oh, I mean, this is a great conversation, Ellis, but really I got you on here to talk about movies and experiences of watching a movie. And the main reason why I wanted to talk to you about great movie going experiences because you were involved in definitely like a top five movie going experience in my life was when we saw Trainspotting.
Yes.
And it was an R-rated, so an 18 plus movie.
Yep.
And me and you and Stu made our merry way to the cinema, rocked up to the counter and said, "Hello! Can we have three tickets to see Trainspotting, please?" And they were like, it was like The Simpsons. Are you 18? Nope. Then you can't see it. Okay. Can you remember what movie?
I think Stu was.
I don't think so. I think it was just before he turned 18. Otherwise, we would have just got him to get three tickets. We were pretty slow, but we weren't that stupid. We could have, if there was one of us 18, he would have got the tickets, but with none of us, and with me looking like I was 10, it was never going to happen. So We regrouped. Can you remember what movie we paid to see?
No, got no idea.
Because the only reason I know this is because it was in my drama folder.
Oh, I was going to say you found it in a jacket pocket from 1996. Or...
Because I'd crossed out the name Twister. Yeah, Twister. I'd crossed that out on the I'd kept the ticket and I crossed out Twister and wrote Trainspotting in there stuck it in my drama book. So yes, we said, oh, three for Twister then, we'll go and see Twister. And then we just walked in and then wait, Trainspotting cinema's just there. And then jumped into the Trainspotting cinema and sat there for a good 10 minutes, like as low as we could in the seats, thinking that, you know, someone was going to come and grab us by the shoulders and throw us out. It never happened, of course.
No, because no one cares.
Because no one cares. No, the people ripping the tickets are like,
God, 14. You've got a good memory. I can't remember that at all. Like, honestly, I remembered going to see Trainspotting.
Yeah.
But I had no record. I remember, this is probably worse. I remember going to, in this, it's on theme, but it was at going to the opening, the grand opening of when Tugra Westfield opened.
Oh, right. Yes. And the big shopping centre in Tugra.
Going with another friend of ours, we will shall refer to as only Mr. S.
Okay.
A-S.
Yeah, and, gotcha.
And sneaking in. And this is because we were well underage at this point, and yeah, sneaking in to see Showgirls.
Oh, wow.
That was a Kenny moment. And we just went up and bought tickets. It was never
a Yeah, right. That's so funny.
but yeah, so going to see, yeah, I remember going to see Trainspotting, but I've completely forgotten the shenanigans around it. And now that you mentioned it, I remember that, as you say, we just go in there, let's just do it. And it was like, no dramas, but yeah.
Maybe it was just me, like, you know, like you think everyone's experienced the same way you are. And I just remember like, wow, oh my God, we get in trouble. Like, I hope we don't get in trouble. And then just watching the movie.
Oh, this doesn't go on my permanent record.
That's right. Exactly.
If I had a girlfriend, she'd kill me.
We're going to get kicked out of the cinema. Oh no, they might call my mom. And just
what a great movie, though. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, honestly, for a bunch of, well, obviously 17-year-olds to sit back and watch like one of the bleakest and yet most uplifting and ambiguous films. Like, you know, it really, it's one of those generational movies, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. Just great. Like, to be like, I've never seen a movie like this before. And like you said, so bleak and like horribly bleak in parts, horribly. And just like, oh, look, heroin looks fun.
Oh, man, how fun did it
heroin
look?
Does not look fun.
but then subsequently going and living in Edinburgh, and every time, like at the top of Leith Walk, just going dun 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 dun. Ah, phenomenal.
Fantastic, wasn't it? Just it's such a great. Like, a lot of movies about drugs are like this, I guess, where the first half is like, look how great drugs are. And you're like, huh. And then look how bad drugs are. But I guess Trainspotting even had that. Like, you can get off drugs and still be a degenerate.
And still, like, be a total tool. Like, that's it. And it's interesting, like, you know, all the follow-ups and everything around it. Like, you know, there's such a huge mythology, like, and once again, living in Edinburgh, and my local used to have Irvin Welsh come in for a drink every now and then. Right, we'd go down, like, I'd come home from work and we'd go into the pub downstairs from where we lived, and Irvin Welsh would be in there having his pints and stuff. And it was just a given. And it that mythology around it kind of deepened because of it, because he was there and everything was kind of happening. And I don't know, it's always just one of those. As I say, it's just been completely mythologized for me now. Like, I can't read, like, it sits on my bookshelf and I'll pick it up. It's one of those books that I will constantly go back and read every couple of years. And it's one of those movies that I just love to go back and watch, because I think it's just so beautifully made. It's like, you know, I think that it's one of the great pieces of British cinema. It really, it captures the essence of the city and the essence of the people and the essence of the country at the time. And there's so many amazing things about it and performances in it, like, you know, Robert Carlyle and
God, yeah. You know, and it's so accessible too. Like, it's very Scottish, yet it's not, I guess it's not too specific to be like,
the bit where they go quite easily been in King's Cross, like, yeah, without doubt.
Yeah. That bit where they go to go and look at the scenery and they're like, what the fuck are we doing here? And he's like, look around here, and he's just like, it's shite being Scottish, and he just rails on what it's like to be Scottish, and you're like, Jesus.
What are you waiting for?
Tommy. This is not natural, man.
It's a great outdoors. It's fresh air.
Look, Tommy, we know you're getting a hard time off Lizzie, but there's really no need to take it out on us.
Doesn't it make you proud to be Scottish?
It's shite being Scottish. We're the lowest of the low. The scum of the fucking earth. The most wretched, miserable, servile, pathetic trash that was ever shot into civilization. Some people hate the English. I don't. They're just wankers. We, on the other hand, are colonised by wankers. Can't even find a decent culture to be colonised by. We're ruled by effete assholes. It's a shite state of affairs to be in, Tommy, and all the fresh air in the world won't make any fucking difference.
Again, like, to be 18 or like 17 and watch it and be like, huh, these guys, like, they're causing all this mayhem and trying to be cool, and they're not even happy with, like, who they are as, like, down to their bones. Like, geez, it's hilarious. I think that, like you said, hilarious and bleak at the same time.
I think that time as well, there was, like, a really kind of weird perceptions of, well, I had very weird perceptions of nationality within Australia. Like, I was going through a bit of a young identity crisis, and I kind of looked, because I think that I remember as a group, we went to see Braveheart.
And that was
kind of a big thing. And then this was very much a counterpoint to that.
Right.
Like, you know, but they were all kind of this anti, like, to a certain degree, the anti-colonialism kind of things, and the anti, like, you know, or the ultra-nationalism and pride in your country and pride in your accent and pride in your faults almost. I think that's what you kind of take away from those kind of movies. And it very much resonated with me as a young, like, at that time. I think that it was a weird point in time. Like, this was the year that you had Pauline Hanson making her debut address to Parliament, my drama monologue was all about a fictional ultra-nationalist movement in Australia, as if that could ever happen.
Yeah, I remember very clearly you telling me, like, did you see what Pauline Hanson said? And I was like, no, who? And you were like, yeah, she pretty much said my speech. You'd already written it, and then she came out.
It was like a week before I was supposed to do it in front of the drama performance.
Right, that's right.
It was a bit nuts. So yeah, but even then, like, you know, and then me leveraging that going into uni as kind of the coastie going to a Sydney uni and sitting there, because I remember all, like, and I was kind of, I was such a dickhead going to New South Uni in Sydney as opposed to going to Newcastle where everyone else was. And I was like, no, I'm going to go to Sydney and, you know, strike it out in the big time and blah, blah, blah.
Was that really part of your choice?
I think so. Huh. Like, I think so. I think it was a rejection of, I think I wanted to be different. Like, it was that I didn't want to go with everyone else being the same. Like, I knew that if I went to Newcastle, there'd be, you know, another 1,000 of people exactly the same as me.
Yeah.
And
that's very, very well observed, because that's pretty much what it was. It was like, huh, I like it here. Everyone's like me.
Yeah. And I really wanted something a bit different. And I thought, oh, you know, at least if I go to, and then I spent the first probably month or so absolutely petrified of the fact that I wasn't there, that I was completely different to everyone else there.
Right.
And and almost fell into this nationalist groove for some reason. I don't really understand why. I was kind of spent this very brief period where I was, and it was that kind of, I completely understand where a lot of young people now kind of get into that right wing or the alt-right kind of frame of mind, because without having your tribe or anything like that. So I think that was kind of where that came from. But it was really interesting that a lot of these kind of films and experiences fed into that, like just that idea that you wanted to finding your tribe and finding your people and finding, you know, where you fit into the world. And I've the best way I figured I could do that was by being as different as possible. It was like, you know, I'd turn up every day in a flannel and tracky dacks and complete, like bogging it out, like just upping the bogan factor as much as I possibly could.
It is interesting what you do at uni, because like I wore an army hat with a Vietnamese pin on it and no shoes. That was my uniform at uni.
Yeah, I like literally like at a Sydney university, which was predominantly, you know, people from Chinese and Singapore and Malaysian background. Like, you know, it was huge Asian population there.
Right.
And my way of standing out and reclaiming my whiteness or whatever it was that I was trying to do
right,
was by wearing thongs and trackies and a flannel and my VB singlet and turning up to, you know, what I considered, which weren't at all, you know, they were just arts courses.
Yes, but that's turning right. You're up like to, Russian
turning up to my Russian lessons and turning up to my pole sci and turning up to my, you know, theatre and film studies lessons in this outfits. And they were costumes.
Yes.
And it was completely trying to shock people by, you know, bogging it out. And it was just, you know, you just wanted to go back and slap yourself around the head, really. And there was a couple of blokes in my course and even some of the tutors, you know, just wanting to call me out. And full respect to them, they didn't. But fuck me, I deserved it. Like, you know, just horrible. Yes,
you're right. The costumes that you wear that, you know, if anyone ever challenged you, you'd be like, what? No, this is just what I'm wearing. I don't even put thought into it. I'm like, really? Cool.
Yeah.
You put shoes on? Nah. Why aren't you wearing shoes? Don't feel like it. Okay. So where we got there from Trainspotting. That's fantastic.
Trainspotting.
So do you have any other memorable like movie going experiences that you can recall?
Probably another big one for me. There's probably three, and I'll see how we go for time. But one of the big ones was going to see A Clockwork Orange.
Wow.
For the first time at the cinema. So that was because I've got this really, really vivid memory of talking about this film from a really early age. This is going to sound a bit weird, but Dad was talking about this film, and it was like, you know, we were talking about, you know, what's your favorite film? And I think we just kind of come off the back of kind of segues well in, but we just kind of our first family film outing was going to see Back to the Future 2.
Nice.
So we'd been to see our next door neighbor had recommended this film Back to the Future back when we'd just gotten our first VHS player and everything. So as a family, we watched Back to the Future on VHS, and I've never seen Mum enjoy a piece of entertainment like she watched this show, except for maybe A Country Practice.
Your mum's very similar to my mum that way. I always found her so reserved, and that's exactly what my mum was like. Probably like three movies where it's the same, where my mum enjoyed herself watching.
Yeah, like she almost when she laughed, she did it with regret almost. It was like this thing.
It's so accurate. Well said.
Yeah. Like she just sits there, like, you know, especially at the swearing and stuff like that. Like, you know,
yeah.
What's happened, Doc? Do we turn into assholes or something?
Like
her trying to stop herself from pissing herself laughing, but not being able to because she's enjoyed this entire movie and just fallen in love with Michael J. Fox up to the point. So, you know, so we'd come off the back of that. And I think I remember we were driving along Wyong Road between Tumbiumbi and Berkeley Vale and asking Dad, what's your favorite movie? And he said, oh, it's one that you may not get a chance to see. And I said, oh yeah. I was about 10 or 11 at the time.
Yeah.
So what was it? And he was like, it's called A Clockwork Orange, and it's probably one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen, but it's one of the greatest movies you will ever see. And it just kind of, for my dad, who was incredibly, once again, reserved, like that's a big statement, especially when you're talking about art or anything like that. That was a big thing. So it's always kind of piqued my interest. Like there was this, it was like the holy grail for me of movies to go and see.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, back in the day before everything was accessible. Like, you know, you had to go and it was either at the movies or not at all for a lot of these types of things.
Well, that's the exact same for me was The Exorcist, and I think I spoke about this previously, but that was the same thing. Like, Dad showed us all kinds of horrible things that I really shouldn't have seen when I was very young. And then we were like, oh, what's the scariest movie or something? And he was like, oh, The Exorcist, but you're not watching that. We're like, and then, of course, it just builds like mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was this big mythology around Clockwork Orange, and then, but then actually going to see it, and I read the book before going to see the movie. So read the book and absolutely loved it. Just thought it was phenomenal. Like, you know, and I think that, you know, Burgess's writing was amazing as well, but I'd read as everything I possibly could about this film. Like, you know, and I'll, you know, subscribing to film magazines and reading all about, you know, everything that Kubrick did in order to create this film and all of this. So I'd created this movie in my head before I'd even gone to see it. But then it was very, very rarely it would come on at the Village, in the Village cinemas in Sydney.
Yeah.
So they'd have like very limited runs for like a weekend or something like that. And so eventually I think it was me and one of our mates went down there, and probably about 1994, 1995.
Right.
And it was running, and we went down to Sydney and went and saw Clockwork Orange on the big screen, and just being from the get-go. And I think, and like, you know, it was one of those things because it'd been built up so much. I'd kind of knew what to expect so much. It was still a phenomenal experience. Like, it did not let me down. I still just can remember sitting there, and because it feels very dated.
Yes.
But it feels of its time as well. Like, it feels intentionally dated. Like, I don't think you could create
that movie. Yeah, because it's so stylistic. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Like, it was... it's of its time, but it's also beyond its time. Like, as I say, I just can't imagine that movie being made much differently, because it's kind of from that extrapolation from the 1960s and 70s or early 70s.
And I think like you said, it's of its time. I think the unsettling nature of it is the same as it would have been. Like, it's not, sometimes this movie was shocking when it first came out, and then you watch it and you're like, oh yeah, but Kubrick does this thing in nearly every film he's ever made where you're just like, I don't feel great. I always feel kind of, even 2001, the first time I saw it, I was like, is this the first scene with all the monkeys? Is this meant to make me feel ill? I don't know.
The first time
I heard like John Coltrane as well, like that kind of music that's discordant, and where you're like, why am I so uncomfortable?
That's it. And I think that even in my head, like, you know, listening, like reading the book and reading all of the passages about the movie, I just sat there and just thought about, you know, this Beethoven blaring out with this orchestral greatness, and then watching the movie and it wasn't like that at all. That was probably the most jarring element for me, but at the same time, it resonated so hard. It's just the most, as I say, discordant and... unpleasant experience, but just from that first scene, my eyes did not leave the screen. And as you say, there's that pure discomfort, but so wonderfully and masterly. I was willing to let myself go into that movie, and I don't know if I would have had the same experience if I hadn't have built it up so much.
Yeah,
but I just knew, and it would, and I think it was one of those kind of very few, like, I don't think we get those kind of very pure cinema experiences much anymore.
No.
Like, it's very difficult for us to achieve through, there's so much, you know too much and you can see too much, and there's so many different avenues of seeing film, that to actually have something which, at that time, I thought this is going to be one of the few opportunities I'll have to see this film.
Yeah.
Because there was no option of it coming out on video or anything like that. That was always kind of barred. Kubrick had always said, no, it's only going to be a cinema-only release.
I think I saw it at uni, like on a VHS, but you could only watch it at the library.
Oh, okay.
Like, you couldn't take it home.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was as I say, it was just a really – it was a very pure cinema experience. It sounds really wanky saying that, and I kind of want to – punch myself in the face for saying it, but at the same time, it was a very cool film moment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's It's when you said, like, I don't know if we have that experience much anymore. I would agree, but there is something which I try to seek out those moments. So when a movie comes along, and I think I might have done this first with like Being John Malkovich when that came out.
Yeah.
I think I saw it on at the movies with David and Margaret, of all people, talking about how great it was. And I remember watching like a little snippet of it and going, I want to watch this movie, and then not seeking out anything, not reading about it, not reading reviews, and then going to see it and just being completely immersed in it. And I've done that ever since. If a movie catches my eye and I'm like, oh, that looks, I want to see that, then I try and shut out everything else. And
yeah, I completely agree with that, and I understand that. But I suppose the point I was trying to get is that now we know.
You mean with like an older film?
There's going to be another opportunity to see it,
right?
Like,
oh,
if you don't get
yeah.
to the cinema gotcha. To see it, yes. you know that you're going to be able to catch it on a streaming service, or you're going to be able to download it from somewhere. You'll be able to find that movie somewhere. I can find A Clockwork Orange now in 100 different places.
Yes, but right. Yes, I had the same thing with Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
where I saw it in Newcastle and thought, now I haven't seen this video anywhere. I know it's hard to get, and so going to see it. And then, of course, like 6 months later, you can get it on video, and now again,
yeah,
like, you can
absolutely.
See it everywhere.
I think, and it's kind of disappointing because, and I think that's kind of where that cult status is being eroded a bit, especially in regards to film. Like, you can still get it around a lot of, you know, sketch comedy and comedians and things like that. And I think that's still, if anything, the culture around the internet is propagating it. But I think that, you know, around that sense around cinema and film and being able to, this is the only place where you can possibly see this. And I think that's where things like The Room are so successful, because they're pure cinematic experiences. You can't not experience it, that unless you're with an audience. Like, you know, that's it has to be within the cinema. And it's a really unique thing to have.
Yeah, I mean, The Room is just the crappy movie fest we used to have, like, taken to its natural conclusion, isn't it?
Just like, phenomenal.
Just like, let's watch the worst movies, but when you watch them with a group, they're hilarious. And now it's like, yes, going to see an event of terrible movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know why The Room, like, I understand why it's a phenomenon, but I don't know why it's like one of the only ones. Like, you would think, like, people like The Room to watch it with joy. There's so many movies that are terrible, like The Room, that you'll have a lot of fun watching with a group of people.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but I think that because it's done so sincerely.
Yes. Yes.
Like, I think, and that it's the, and I think that's where the joy for The Room comes from. And I'm not saying that, you know, Thing with Two Heads wasn't done sincerely. And you know, there's a lot of fantastic, crappy movies out there which would equally deserve it, but it's just done with so earnest in its approach, and it just works so perfectly because of that. And that every performance is done with so much sincerity.
Yes, it's the sincerity that, you're right, like, it has to be done with the earnestness does make things funny. It's the same at school. Like, I have to read poetry written by teenagers. It's the most
amazing, is it?
It's the most earnest stuff, and that's always, like, I can say, Justine, I want to read you a poem. I had a student the other day, and it's a good poem, and I was kind of disappointed, but the poem was called Who Am I? And I was like, oh, geez, strap yourself in, Justine, listen to this. It's called Who Am I? But it was actually quite good, but I was like, please change the title. I don't know whether I should ask them to change the title, simply because as a teacher, my first reaction was to laugh at your poem because it was called Who Am I?
Yeah. It's that thing of, you know, I think that, you know, all the cringe comedies have diluted a lot of those. Like, you know, you can't get away with it anymore. You have to do, it has to be completely sincere for it to work.
Yeah.
And that's where The Room hits. And this is it. Like, you know, there's everything's so postmodern. It's the classic line in The Simpsons, like, you know, oh yeah, cool. Are you being sarcastic? I don't even know anymore.
I don't even
like,
know.
Like, you know, that's just the way that so many things are now. So it was kind of anything which has any sense of purity that we can hold up for ridicule is fantastic.
That is true. All right. Well, what are some other lovely movie experiences?
Well, I touched on the fact that the whole family was the only time that my whole family went to see a movie was Back to the Future 2, mm-hmm. and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
The other one, I suppose, that really stands out, and this is kind of a bit of a, I don't know if there's much of a story here, but it was just, for me, it was one of the most unique cinema going experiences was living in Edinburgh and stockpiling on mushrooms before they actually made them illegal.
Right.
So there was a point in time where you could buy psychedelic mushrooms and pretty much as many as you wanted. And so we went and we bought about a kilo's worth and cooked them all into pasties and froze them down and weren't sure if that was going to work or not. We ate quite a few of them, but then we had about four left, and me and one of the other bartenders we both worked the day shift, and he just said, "Oh, I really fancy going to see a film." And I said, "Oh, I've still got four of these pasties in there.
Yeah.
You want to go see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory?"
Like and the original?
So, this is Charlie the Chocolate Factory, not Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory. This is that was the new one. So this is the thing, like, you know, and this is where, and this is my whole point of this story is it's all about perception.
Yes.
Because I still love the new, I love the old one, but I still love, I've kind of alluded to my displeasure with Gene Wilder, which I'm slowly getting over, but
it's still mystifying. I don't know if it's mystifying, but
no,
I was shocked by it.
I think it comes from my parents.
Right.
I think it comes from, I think that I'm so heavily influenced by what my parents think and believe about certain actors.
That's probably true. Like the reason why I like Gene Wilder is because my dad, one of his favorite movies is Young Frankenstein. So I watched a lot of Gene Wilder growing up.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I don't know. I just got this weird recollection of mum and or dad being uncomfortable with Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
And I don't recall them having a particular issue with him in anything else because we watched, you know, Gene Wilder movies.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
we watched Gene Wilder collection. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we watched Young Frankenstein. We watched Stir Crazy. We watched
See No Evil.
Like, you know, that might have been more of a Richard Pryor thing than a Gene Wilder thing. But, you know, that was definitely there. But for some reason, there was always this weird displeasure about Gene Wilder and a discomfort which carried with me for a long time. And looking back and watching him, he's very, very good in the movie. Like, you know, and it's something which I've had to come to terms with.
Yeah. I had the same thing with the movie Matilda. I mean, stupidly, it was one of my favorite books growing up, but I went to see it when I was 18 and was like, nah. No, this isn't like the book. This is dumb. This movie sucks. I hate that girl playing Matilda. That's not the Matilda. Anyway, like just that stupid reaction. And then my kids started watching and I was like, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
This is actually really good. Well done, everyone.
I think that's exactly the way I feel about. And I think that his performance is incredibly nuanced. And I don't think I appreciated that for whatever reason, I decided to blank it.
Yeah. We got sidecracked. Sorry, you went to see the Tim Burton Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
This is kind of in reverse. So
right.
I on Mushrooms going to see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And it was phenomenal going to see that movie on Mushrooms. Like it is like literally, I don't think I've watched it several times since.
Yeah.
And each time a little bit of the the color fades.
Right.
But I definitely think that Tim Burton had designed that to be viewed while tripping pretty hard because
there's some good design. Like, I know what you mean.
The faces, the close-ups, the shots, everything is sat there in order to make it as trippy as possible. Like, you know, we went and saw this movie and then like the next week we said, right, we'll watch the original High Mushrooms. We went and did that and it was nowhere near the same experience. It might have been a cinema going thing, like sitting in a cinema in Edinburgh with, you know, scattered families and two incredibly high, you know, fellas who hadn't been to sleep for probably a couple of days by that point you know, a couple of hours sleep and just sitting there watching in this cinema. It was just like a multiplex. It was an incredible experience. And just as I say, it was a cinematic experience. It was one of those things that you couldn't replicate in your lounge room, and one of those things that that's why you love movies.
Yeah.
And I miss it. I miss it so much. Like my other kind of general experience was just coming back to Australia from after being in the UK for a bit and living with mum and dad, and every Tuesday night heading across to the cinema for Tight Ass Tuesday. And
yeah,
didn't matter what movie was on, you pay $5 and go and watch a movie in the cinema and sit there. And there was usually 3 or 4 people there, and seeing some absolutely ripping cinema,
yeah,
and seeing some absolute dogs. But you know, it was that experience of sitting there in the dark and not knowing and enjoying. And you know, that was where I saw The Big Lebowski for the first time, and
yeah,
some of those, just, you know, the movies you wouldn't normally go and see. And yeah, it was phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing, we our children are getting older and getting closer and closer to an age where Jazz and I can go back to the movies as much as we used to, but then is there going to be the movies we want to see on at the movies unless they're like re-releases? And that's what we're finding fairly recently. I'm hoping to sit down with her and have a chat, because this year I think we went and saw 3 movies in the cinema fairly recently, and they were all re-released movies, and great, but it's kind of like, well, like, you have to seek out those new movies, you know, like when we saw Parasite in the cinema, that was, I'd seen a poster for it. And it said, it had just won Cannes, I think. And it said, it's only going to be in Canberra for 1 week. And I just said, oh, this dude, I knew the director. Yeah. He did The Host. We really liked The Host. And I said, all right. And we went, I think we're going to see a movie. And I said, I'm going to get tickets straight away, and we went and saw that. And that was like one of those things where you're like, when you have that freedom, we were lucky to be able to do that with kids, but having that freedom when our kids are older to just go and see movies, because we used to go, you know, I think we might have gone 4 days in a row at one point before we had kids. Just
see, that's just, and that's my dream. Like, you know, I think about how much I used to go to the movies and then how little I've gone in the last, even I'd say 15 years. Like, you know, I was an avid moviegoer for most of my life. Like, you know, from an early age, like me and my little brother, we were living down the entrance, and they just refurbished the little entrance cinema.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. It was such a cool little cinema. And they'd do, literally during the school holidays, they'd have $2.50 movies. So kids would go in and they'd have a couple of cartoons, and then they'd have one of the kids' movies on. And me, for mum to get me and my brother out of the house, we were just old enough. Probably weren't, actually. Probably about 8 or 9.
Right. Yeah.
But we'd walk down into the cinemas. We'd go and chuck an 18-cent 1.25-litre Coke in the freezer at Coles, go for a bit of a walk around, come back, pick it up.
I've never thought of that before.
It's the
Jesus,
best movie.
That's genius.
Sit with that, smuggle that in with another couple of packets of chips or whatever, your packet of tubes, and sit and watch the movies. Wow. But then, and as I say, like, I don't know what happened. Like, I don't know whether it was what definitely wasn't a conscious kind of reflex against the multiplexes or anything like that. But a lot of that romance around the cinema, I don't know. I lost it.
Oh.
And I'd love to get it back. Like, well, you know,
one thing that will help you get that back is getting your kids over the hump of having to take them to see shit films, which I've done my time. I've already told them this. No, I'm not going to see that. I've seen Alvin and the Chipmunks 4, The Road Chip. Ugh. And so that was the nadir of like cinema going experiences in my life, where even at one point Violet turned to me and said, "You're not enjoying this, are you?" No, I'm not. But, you know, I took them to see Little Women, like the latest version of that. And they were like, "Oh, really?" And I'm like, "You know what? You owe me seeing this." And so they sat there. It was, you know, it's quite long, but they liked it. But I knew, like, we're at this age, you're at this age now, I'm going to start taking this stuff. But the thing that will get you back into it is going to see movies, seeking out movies that are re-released that you know they'll enjoy. I took the girls in Canberra, we have the National Film and Sound Archives, and they show movies, and some of them are new and some of them are old. And I've shown them Edward Scissorhands, which Violet was completely in love with, has watched it many times over. And even though you could just stream them, they're on Netflix or whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
Going to see them there. I mean, we went to see Coraline recently, and they've seen that movie 20 times. It's one of their favorites. Yeah. And we went to see it, and we went to see it with friends and their kids. And it was just so great to be in the cinema and watching it, and just the getting them to be like, yeah, it's better. It's always better in the cinema. Because it's too easy. It's too easy just to watch it at home.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think that's the unique thing that we need to kind of come back to with kind of everything. Like, you know, I think any kind of live performance or where you're forced to do something, it's far too easy now to stop doing what you're doing and come back to it later type thing. Because, you know, and it's something which perpetually worries me. And we've kind of talked about this on our other podcast, Dad Pants, if anyone's out there looking for that something else
Dad
to listen
Pants.
To. Dad Pants.
What a great podcast Dad Pants is.
But like the possibilities of kids, you know, they can go and they can literally watch shows back to back forever. Like, you know, sit there and watching nothing but Paw Patrol. They're not getting any variation in their diet. Like, where's the, you need to have a bit of everything to realize, so that you realize what you do and don't like. If you're just getting the same thing, you're just not going to realize what's out there. And that really concerns
me. It's not the same thing. It's just getting what you like all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what I mean. But it's getting a diet of nothing but lollies. Like, you know, whereas you got to eat your vegetables to realize that actually they're actually pretty tasty. They're not just good for you.
Yeah.
You need to branch out and see what else is there. But it's not even like that, because there's so many cool and quality things that you would never know unless you get out there and see a bit of different stuff. But, you know, I don't know. I'm definitely looking forward to taking, it's been so tough. Like, you know, I've taken, Tilly's seen two movies at the cinema. Georgie's never been to the cinema.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's been two and now he's three. He's probably at an age where he could possibly sit there.
Yeah, that's dicey. It's pretty dicey. Yeah, like it's half a movie really at three.
And I suppose I'll finish that up on my number one cinema moment, which is one of my earliest memories as well, was Dad taking me to see Return of the Jedi for my fourth birthday present.
Yeah, nice.
And that was like, and it was my present, because I remember we, you know, and you were probably fairly similar. Like, you know, we weren't rich. We weren't like, you know, we never kind of wanted for food or anything like that. Like, we weren't dirt poor, but we didn't have many extras or anything. And so it was kind of
it was an event. You know, anytime we went to the movies, it was an event.
Well, but it wasn't even the fact, this was the first time it was even offered. This was my birthday present.
Oh, right.
You know, your birthday present. You can have a present or you can go to the movies and watch this movie. And I was like, no, I want to go and see this thing.
No contest.
Because it looks amazing. Like, you know, I'd only seen it on TV. I'm four. Like, I had no fucking idea.
Yeah.
But then I remember that going to the Village Twin at Gosford.
Right.
And getting the soft drink and definitely, we never were a popcorn family and we aren't now, but getting some, I think I had a box of Smarties that Dad smuggled in his pocket, and sitting there and watching Return of the Jedi and watching that opening scene of the musical around and the title sequence roll in front of you. That's a profound moment, which is long lasting and just stays with you forever. Like, you know, for all you want to say about the Star Wars movies and everything like that, that is an iconic opening sequence from any movie.
I mean, I still agree. I mean, when The Phantom Menace came out, and I got to see it for free with Wicca, like the day before it came out, just on a weird, like on a great chance, I still think the music starting and the credits rolling may be the most excited I've ever been in a cinema.
It gives you goosebumps.
And I think that's why that movie's hated so much, is because that was the first moment of the movie. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, this is so great.
This is happening.
And then you have to watch it. Then you have to sit through it. I could have left. I could have left then. I wish if I go back in time, just go, you can leave now. That's it. It's not getting better than that. But yeah, that you're right. Like, the starting music. I was lucky. Yeah. I saw Return of the Jedi. How awesome is this? At Avoca Beach Theater.
That's a great cinema.
Where they
watched lots of good movies at Avoca. Yeah.
Where they played a double feature. They played Empire, and then they played Return of the Jedi. on its like when it was first released. How genius is that?
I was the same age.
I must have been the same age as you.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great cinemas, the old Evoca cinemas. I watched lots of really good movies there. They have lots of great events there still.
Saw Three Amigos there. Like it has Spaceballs, I might have seen there. There's a lot of great memories of that theater.
No, there's Spaceballs.
My daughter loves space. Noelle loves Spaceballs.
It makes how so good happy. Is Spaceballs?
Yeah. She made me, because I can make stickers at school, print them out. She made me design a sticker that says Spaceballs the sticker. And I was like, that is amazing. Thank you. I will happily do that. She got that on her wall.
That is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, she's good.
So good.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up because we've been waffling on.
Thank you so much. That was a lovely chat.
Just what was needed. A cleanser, palate cleanser. Go back to being sad. All right. Thanks, Ellis.
Cheers, Barry.
That's it.